From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Government secrets, the right to privacy, and national security. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. An order by a secret court has been released and published. It requires Verizon to produce records of every communication on landline or cell phone. Content will not be monitored, but some say it's a massive invasion of privacy. The administration and its allies are calling it critical for national security. Is it something new or an extension of what started during the Bush years? Will the publication produce another leak investigation? At the same time, the espionage trial of PFC Bradley Manning is just beginning. He released 700,000 classified documents to WikiLeaks. Is he a whistleblower or a traitor who deserves life in prison? First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. The espionage trial of PFC Bradley Manning for a massive leak of classified documents is just getting underway. Critics say he betrayed his country. Manning's defenders are framing the case in part as a challenge to what they call excessive classification of information that the public has a right to know. We'll have more on that later. Today, a new controversy may pit national security against personal privacy. Or it might not. The Guardian newspaper has published the order of a secret so-called FISA court. It requires Verizon to provide the National Security Agency with records of every cell phone or landline call in its system, both international and domestic. California Democrat Dianne Feinstein, who's chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, confirms the report.
The information goes into a database, the metadata, but cannot be accessed without what's called, and I quote, reasonable, articulable suspicion that the records are relevant and related to terrorist activity.
Siobhan Gorman is intelligence reporter for the Wall Street Journal. And Siobhan, it's good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you.
What does the senator mean when she uses the term metadata?
Metadata is the data about your communications. So for a phone call, it's basically the type of information you would see on your phone bill. That would be the date and time that the call was placed, how long the call was, which number called which number, on a landline, it's the location, and for a cell phone, it would be the nearest cell phone tower.
So this includes then, if you use technical terminology that's in the order, the originating and terminating number, the duration of each call, the card numbers, the trunk identifiers, the international mobile subscriber identity number, and comprehensive communication routing information. That's a lot of technical stuff, but that's really what it's about.
That is what it is about. It's a lot of information about which numbers or which individuals really are communicating with which individuals and by what means. And so that's the information they're collecting.
Does it open the possibility of monitoring the content, even though that's not part of the order?
It does, but what it would provide is information that investigators could compile to try to make the case that they have justification to get a warrant to listen in on conversation, for example, or get a full copy of email.
Could it be that other telephone companies besides Verizon have received similar orders from the FISA court?
Yes, based on my reporting, my understanding is that all the major telecoms and internet service providers have had similar requests. For data.
You've been reporting on this since 2008. So what about
the— I've been reporting on this since 2005.
2005. Okay. Excuse me for not going back far enough. What about blurring the line between domestic and foreign surveillance? Is that important? Is that something new?
Well, it's not new. This has been the question about NSA's involvement in what was called either warrantless surveillance. Some people called it domestic surveillance during President Bush's program. I mean, he initiated these practices, some of which were eavesdropping on actual conversations. This is a different component of that program, which has to do with collecting the data. And this basically 9/11 ushered NSA into a whole new realm where it was touching on domestic collection far more than it ever had been in the past. And that was what created so much debate sort of 7 or 8 years ago.
Well, what about now? Has there been an uptick as a result of the Boston Marathon bombing?
An uptick in what way?
In the domestic surveillance.
Concern
about homegrown terrorism, as it's called.
Well, there's more concern about homegrown terrorism, although for the folks at the FBI who have been following this for quite some time, they've been concerned for many years about homegrown terrorism. I mean, there wouldn't be an uptick in collection, so to speak, on NSA's part, because they're collecting everything all the time. And part of their argument for why they need to collect all of this data all of the time is that you never know when you'll need it.
To what extent is this raised criticism about potential excesses and particularly violations of privacy?
It's raised a lot of questions about that. The American Civil Liberties Union immediately put out statements last night saying that this was a broad overreach. And many people, I spoke with a former NSA official who said that this violates the Fourth Amendment. So there is a big question there about whether or not collecting so much of this data and being able to analyze it so carefully does end up leading to a violation of privacy. That's just the laws that govern these practices predate cell phones, so they didn't really contemplate the kind of information that we now have access to, or that the government now has access to.
The Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable search and seizure.
Correct.
So even an NSA operative or a former one is concerned about that.
Oh, NSA, yeah. I mean, NSA, when you talk with NSA employees, they live and die by the Fourth Amendment. They're actually very, very conscientious about it, which is why some of them get very bothered by these types of practices, because they feel like they don't have the appropriate checks. What the administration says is that this is an effort that is operating under a lot of checks and balances. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court oversees it. Congress oversees it and whatnot.
Okay. Siobhan Gorman with the Wall Street Journal. Many thanks for being with us. We'll be right back and continue this conversation on To the Point.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. A little bit later, we'll be talking about the Bradley Manning court-martial that has been just getting underway this week. But here again, with regard to the recent revelation of the court order from the FISA court, is California Democrat Dianne Feinstein, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee.
As far as I know, this is the exact 3-month renewal of what has been the case for the past 7 years. This renewal is carried out by the FISA court under the business records section of the Patriot Act. Therefore, it is lawful. It has been briefed to Congress.
Stephen Wicker is professor of electrical and computer engineering at Cornell University. He's author of an upcoming book, Cellular Convergence and the Death of Privacy. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Do you agree with the senator that this is, in fact, legal?
I'm not a lawyer, but I don't think I interpret the statutes the same way she does. I'd specifically point to the fact that this doesn't specify an individual. This court order is a huge fishing expedition without naming anybody.
What's wrong with that?
Well, it gets back to actually our colonial days, the idea of the general warrant. You basically give someone the right to search wherever they want when they don't even know what they're looking for. I think that's problematic.
David Rifkin is a lawyer. He's a Washington attorney, expert on national security law, was in the Department of Justice and the White House during the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. David Rifkin, good to have you back on our program.
Good to be with you.
What do you say? You are a lawyer. Is this a fishing expedition? Does it go back to colonial days? Is it too broad?
Of course not. And the easiest question here, the easiest question by which no reasonable lawyers should have any disagreement about, is whether or not it implicates any constitutional issues, in particular the Fourth Amendment. And the answer is no. The reason is, in the leading case, it's a little old, but still very good, Smith versus Maryland, 1979 Supreme Court case, stands clearly the proposition that there are no reasonable expectation of privacy in the third-party records. These are not even the records that an individual creates and then shares with one third party and maybe gets passed to another. These are records that are created by the third party. There are no constitutional issues involved whatsoever. Okay? The only question is whether or not this order is consistent with very broad, very permissive standards set by Congress in Section 215 of the Patriot Act. And with respect to my colleague here, they do. That if you, I mean, I could read you that language chapter and verse. It doesn't talk at all about a specific person. The whole point of gathering what is called metadata is to get huge volumes of it to see patterns. It has nothing to do with individuals. And the language, I mean, just you know, not to read the whole thing, is it basically requires that you provide an application that states facts, that what you're dealing with is an authorized investigation, which, of course, we have, which can be multiple investigations, and involving activities of suspected agent or agents of foreign power.
Okay, let me go back, or excuse me, let me introduce Kathleen McClellan, who is an attorney, National Security and Human Rights Counsel at the Government Accountability Project. Good to have you on our program. Do you, like Stephen Wicker, our professor at Cornell University, have a different reading of the statute, you with the background of being an attorney?
Absolutely. There's a different reading to the statute. There's no conceivable way that the government can argue that collecting millions of innocent Americans' phone calls is linked enough to an international terrorism or clandestine intelligence activities, and that's what Section 215 requires. This is exactly what Senators Ron Wyden of Oregon and Mark Udall of Colorado were talking about when they said that the public would be shocked and angry because the Justice Department's interpretation of Section 215 is so wild, radically different from the text of the statute.
Let me go back to Stephen Wicker, the professor at Cornell University. What about the relationship between the subscriber to Verizon or to any other phone company and the is that violated, do you think, by this order, or is it a requirement of that kind? Should Verizon and other companies make clear when they get these orders?
I think so. I think that first thing I want to note, there was a reference to the Smith case and its precursor, the Miller case. Those cases were decided in a day when the data that was being provided to the third parties was not as revealing. Today's cellular data reveals an immense amount about the beliefs and preferences of the individual. And when we give that data to our service providers, we expect them to treat it properly. So I think there is a trust, and I think that trust is being broken when the service providers don't at least put up a fight when these requests are made.
What about the law? Do you think the law has failed to catch up with the technology? Is that one of the points you're making?
Oh, that's certainly the case. The law, in fact, the senator earlier that you quoted was quoting from the ECPA. It's clear that technology has far outstripped the ECPA. The distinction between context and content has become so blurred, it's really difficult to see the difference. And yet that's exactly where our law sits. It's you can't listen to the conversation, but you can know all the data about it otherwise.
The ECPA is the Patriot Act?
That's the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. The Patriot Act modified it somewhat.
Okay. David Rifkin, back to you. What about this, that we have technology now that simply wasn't contemplated when the law was written?
Well, two things. Again, I wish we would not waste time arguing the Fourth Amendment because, frankly, this argument is ridiculous. What matters is that we have third-party records. The extent to which they're revealing, the extent to which they're voluminous, are stigmatizing is irrelevant. There's no expectation of privacy, no reasonable expectation of privacy, but the Constitution protects in third-party records. If you go in a business for the bank or a phone company and they produce records, you know that. You're not even the one producing them. They're going to produce records. You have no constitutionally protected expectation of privacy. That has not changed since the Smith case. As to the language about which we're talking about, it's purely a statutory argument. Oh, and by the way, the reason the phone companies are not telling their subscribers. By the way, remember, we're getting the entire dump on a continuous basis of all telephony metadata in the United States. Who am I supposed to notify? The whole point here, and this is what I call them privacy crowds, don't seem to appreciate, there's a great deal of relief for them in the sheer volume of it, because it's so huge. Who am I supposed to notify? Everybody in the United States?
Okay, Kathleen McClellan, how do you respond to that, again, with the Government Accountability Project?
Well, absolutely, there's certain benefit to having a lot of data, but ironically, it was never necessary to violate Americans' privacy rights, or even if, like Mr. Rivkin not credibly says they don't have privacy rights, there's no need to collect this kind of data on Americans in order to protect the country. And here at the Government Accountability Project, we've represented NSA whistleblowers, National Security Agency whistleblowers, Thomas Drake, William Binney, and J. Kirk Wiebe. And Binney and Wiebe designed a program that would protect Americans' privacy while collecting enough data in order to stop potential international terrorism or clandestine intelligence activities. And regardless of whether or not there's an expectation of privacy, we need to look at whether or not it's efficient for the government to be collecting dossiers on everybody in the United States. And it doesn't seem that learning so much about innocent Americans is going to tell the government anything about national security.
Where do you get dossiers when we understand that what they're collecting is really a lot of very technological information about what happens, as Mr. Rivkin points out, ultimately controlled by a third party?
Well, I think that once you take all of the third-party electronic data that's out there, and that's what Section 215 allows, the order that was leaked to The Guardian is limited to phone call records, but Section 215 is not limited to phone calls or even communications. It's limited to all third-party data. And so when you take all of the electronic data on Americans out there, if the Justice Department's broad interpretation of Section 215 allows the order that was leaked, then who's to say it doesn't allow any number of other secret orders? We don't know. They're all secret. And if you can take all of the electronic data, your bank records, your phone records, your email records, your EasyPass records, your MetroCard records, you can name any amount of electronic data, you can map someone's entire day's worth of activities using metadata alone. And so the idea that we should be comforted because the government is not listening to the phone calls, that's cold comfort. It's not. We should not feel as though we have more privacy protections because they're not actually listening to the phone calls.
And David Rivkin, presumably they could listen to the phone calls if they chose to do so. You say there's no legal protection for that because it's a third-party record, but how secure should people feel about their communications? And should they simply assume whenever they talk on the phone that somebody's going to be listening?
Two points. First of all, this is not the section that's used to obtain information about the content. There's an opportunity.
How do we know, since the orders are all secret?
Well, if you look at the language of a section, plus the fact that there are other provisions in FISA itself, and in regular non-national security situations, or so-called Title III warrants, if there's reasonable suspicion that an individual is engaged in commission of crimes, you can go to a magistrate and get a Title III warrant, or you can go to a FISA if you believe an individual is an international terrorist, or it's slightly lower standard than are called warrants, they're called orders, or you can go and get an individual-specific or a network-specific order under FISA. But a second point is very important for your listeners to appreciate. This is not, repeat, not about mapping anybody's path, travel path, or anything like that. And the reason you need as much data as possible is because it obviously hasn't occurred to my colleague that the only way in which you can have a reliable definition of what's an anomaly. Because remember, it is like tracks in the snow. They're looking for anomalies. They're looking for deviations. The only way to know what's an anomaly deviation is to have this robust appreciation of what is the normal pattern. This
Stephen Ricker, back to you. Excuse me for interrupting, but I'm doing that in the interest of time. Isn't the whole purpose in order to have a record in the event, as we understood it from Senator Feinstein, or as others have said she has implied, isn't the whole point, in case somebody becomes suspect of involvement in terrorism or some other crime, then you have a record available you can go look at?
Well, the point's certainly well taken. And from law enforcement's perspective, if they had all the data you could possibly imagine, they would certainly be in a good position to respond quickly to events like the Boston bombing. But platforms like the cellular platform are also important for speech purposes, and in particular political speech. And there's a dampening effect of knowing that you could be listened to at any point in time. We benefit from the free expression as much and potentially more than we benefit from the law enforcement potential of the device. So I would argue there's got to be a trade-off. You've got to find the balance, and that's why we have a Fourth Amendment, to establish such a balance. I certainly agree with my colleague that, sure, we're looking for anomalies, but you know, we have to find the balance. We can't just collect all the data and treat everyone as a potential suspect.
Kathleen McClellan with the Government Accountability Project. How much information would be enough information if this kind of thing is available to the government, if there are threats to the country and that they presumably could be prevented perhaps, or at least there could be enforcement of the law as a result of using this data, how much data should be available to the Justice Department and the NSA?
Well, I think the point is, who is the data on? You know, the Justice Department and the NSA have broad power to obtain data on anybody that they have probable cause or even less than probable cause to suspect has committed a crime. And that's absolutely fine. If there is a reason to suspect someone of criminal activity or of a connection to a foreign power or of international terrorism, then there's absolutely no problem with the government obtaining a warrant and properly getting all of their data, phone calls, call records, bank records, anything of that nature. The problem here is that the government is claiming that they need to get information on everybody in order to somehow find bad guys. Ironically, though, they haven't even been able to do that. They're keeping the information once they know who the bad guys are to go back and look at it. And even worse, none of this was ever necessary. If you listen to the National Security Agency whistleblower clients we have, they've been saying for years now that they had a tool in place that both protected privacy and protected the country. There was a way to do both, but the government chose to collect information on Americans rather than protecting Americans.
I presume we don't have the time to explain how that system would work, but David Rifkin, with 15 seconds left in our this part of our program, if that sort of a system were available, why wouldn't the government choose it?
Because I think the answer from my colleague illustrates that this is a myth. The whole point here is that the government needs to obtain, very importantly, non-private, not Fourth Amendment protected information, be it cameras in public streets, be it this kind of metadata, to get patterns.
McClellan, will the information, do you think, that your whistleblower clients want to see published be published? Is it possible for that? Can we talk about it?
Sure. In fact, they have already talked about it. The program was called Thin Thread, and the National Security Agency rejected it, in likely because it was too cheap and too efficient, and they wanted to obtain more funding for what turned out to be a billion-dollar boondoggle. And so the program did exist. It was able to protect Americans' privacy. It was ready to deploy prior to 9/11 even, and the National Security Agency rejected that program.
All right. Well, thank you all for being on our program, the first part of our program. We're going to continue this conversation with some of our guests. Others will leave. Back in a moment to talk about the espionage trial of PFC Bradley Manning. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
Worman Olney back with To The Point. PFC Bradley Manning has pled guilty to releasing more than 500,000 classified documents, which WikiLeaks then published on the Internet. That was the largest intelligence breach in American history. At the time, 2010, Manning was working in what's called a sensitive compartmented information facility at Forward Operating Base Hammer near Baghdad. He is now facing a court-martial on espionage charges at Fort Meade, Maryland. Arun Roth is a reporter for Frontline on PBS and for PRI's The World. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Bring us up to date on the trial so far and on the charges. If he's pled guilty to releasing the documents, what's he being tried for that's different?
Well, he hasn't pleaded guilty to all the charges. What's interesting is that he has admitted in a statement that he made a couple of months back, he's admitted to leaking these documents, or at least some of the documents. There's overlap in there, and if you get down into the weeds, there's some disagreement about exactly what he may or may not have leaked. But in terms of the bigger stuff, like these State Department cables, the collateral murder video, all of that stuff, he essentially owned up to it. But he pleaded guilty to reduced versions of certain charges, but the big issues are still on the table. That's the aiding the enemy charge, which could end him up with life in prison. The aspects of the Espionage Act that he's charged under, those are still alive and active. And so this week, it was the beginning of the court-martial. They started off with the opening arguments from prosecution and defense. The peculiar thing was that it actually, after all this delay we've had now, it's been... You know, he's been in prison for over 1,000 days, as reporters are quick to point out. The actual court martial this week moved very, very quickly. They were actually finished with all their witnesses for the week by Wednesday. So that's why, you know, I'm here talking to you on the phone on Thursday. They canceled the court for the rest of the week because they were so far ahead of schedule.
What did they learn from those witnesses?
These have been witnesses that have been talking about a lot of forensic computer experts. These are the people that would, you know, go into the crime scene investigation, but the crime scene being basically that secure area you talked about, the SCIF where Bradley Manning worked. The people that went into his computers and tried to trace either where these files and folders were, communication that he might have had with WikiLeaks, you know, digital trails, that sort of stuff, and to try to, you know, establish, you know, the chain by which he leaked that information. One of the reasons things moved so quickly, though, is that the defense agreed, apparently at the last minute, to stipulate a lot of witness testimony from the prosecution. So they were essentially able to skip past witnesses who were able to submit written testimony that was just entered into the court record.
What about the testimony of the man who outed him to the officials?
That was, you know, I think if there was any individual's testimony that was anticipated, it really would have been, this is Adrian Lamo. This is the hacker who famously befriended Manning and within 24 hours of befriending him on an internet chat decided to turn him into the federal authorities. And he is just hated among both Bradley Manning supporters, obviously, in particular. But it seems like the general hacker community in general really views him as a turncoat. When he came in, even in the media center, there were, you know, practically hisses, like an audible sense of hatred. What was interesting, though, is that even though during the Article 32, which is Bradley Manning's pretrial hearing, the defense spent some time basically trying to undermine him, paint him as an unreliable witness. You know, he's a convicted felon and a drug addict. None of that, though, for the court-martial. During the court-martial, he was off the stand in just a little bit over half an hour, and most of that was basically the defense taking him through his chat log with with Bradley Manning, reading it to him and having him say, yes, he said that. There was a series of lines like that. He would say a line from Bradley Manning. Bradley said, you know, I felt this way, and Adrian Lamo would say yes, and then that was pretty much it.
I mean, was it principally about how Manning felt in terms of his discomfort in the military? Was there anything about actually betraying the country or helping the enemy?
No, the lines that the defense chose to recite back to Adrian Lamo were really personal stuff. It was about the sense of desperation that he was feeling, both feeling out of place in the military, you know, the strain of being a gay soldier under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Also, he just had a relationship which had ended very badly. He was in a really miserable place when he was reaching out to Adrian Lama because he thought of him as sort of a kindred spirit, somebody who had been in trouble with the law before as a hacker, somebody who... And the words of Bradley Manning's lawyer, he actually put this to him and said that, you know, you maybe saw in him a little bit of you know, a young man, a hacker type who is trying to do the right thing and running afoul of the law. And Adrian Lamo said that he thought that characterization was correct. He did sort of see that in him.
He turned him in, but said he thought he was doing the right thing anyway?
Yeah, I mean, he's clearly, Adrian Lamo, he's clearly tortured by this. I mean, he... you know, he said in an interview with us at Frontline that it was the it was something like the least worst choice that he could make. There were no good options. There was only the least worst option because he did feel a connection to Manning, but he also, according to what he said, he was very frightened that Bradley Manning was going to endanger a lot of people by releasing all these documents to the extent that he did. So as he was being led through this sort of step-by-step and having these lines read back to him, It was clearly painful for him, and he almost got the sense that that the lawyer was doing this almost to sort of make him squirm. But what I think it was really about, Warren, was really with an eye towards the sentencing phase, because going through this personal stuff doesn't really add an awful lot in terms of breaking down the charges. But you know, if we're looking towards the sentencing phase, assuming that Bradley Manning is going to be convicted, it's getting this sympathetic stuff out there right now.
Again, Arun Roth is a reporter for PBS's Frontline and PRI's The World, covering the Bradley Manning trial, suspended for the moment because it has been going so quickly. Tim is a writer and lawyer. He's executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, which works to promote and fund aggressive public interest journalism. Good to have you on our program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Was what Bradley Manning did, which was to release in the neighborhood of 700,000 classified documents to WikiLeaks, which published them, was that public interest journalism?
Well, I think it's absolutely had the effect of public interest journalism. I mean, those cables, the State Department cables specifically, have been quoted in hundreds and thousands of newspaper stories, not only in the U.S., but around the world. You can still, to this day, 3 years since he released the information, open up the New York Times or Washington Post on any given day and find that a previously innocuous cable is now being quoted as major news because of events that have happened around the world. So, you know, the information that he released has given the American public just an unprecedented window into how the U.S. government works, and that's incredibly important in a time where a lot of the foreign policy and national security apparatus is considered classified in this country.
Well, wait a minute. You say on the one hand that the same documents are often quoted, and on the other that we now have an unprecedented window into how government works. Did he release a lot of stuff that was new or not?
Oh, absolutely. That's what I'm saying. I think those statements work in concert. You know, we, thanks to the WikiLeaks cables, we now have...
I see. They're quoted because of the WikiLeaks release, is what you're saying.
Right, exactly.
Okay, excuse me. I misunderstood what you said. What about the argument that there was, at least potentially, a lot of information here that might have, as the government charges, aided the enemy?
Well, the aiding the enemy charge is really dangerous when we're talking about journalists and future whistleblowers, no matter what you think of Bradley Manning and his actions. You know, as you mentioned in the previous interview, he's already actually taken responsibility for his actions, and no matter what happens in this trial, we'll be facing 20 years. But this aiding the enemy charge is incredibly dangerous, and I'll give you an example as to why. You know, in the trial, they're going to say that the WikiLeaks cables ended up on Osama bin Laden's computer. Well, Osama bin Laden has also recommended a book by Bob Woodward called Obama's Wars to all his supporters. He's done so publicly. You know, the books that Bob Woodward writes contain highly classified information, much higher classification than anything in the WikiLeaks cables, and he talks to all of the top generals in the U.S. as his sources. Going by the logic in the government's case against Bradley Manning, all of Bob Woodward's sources have aided the enemy. You know, the charge is just incredibly broad, saying that, you know, they're not alleging that Bradley Manning directly handed things to Osama bin Laden or al-Qaeda to harm the United States. They're saying essentially that because these documents ended up on the internet and al-Qaeda has an internet connection, that somehow that's aiding the enemy. Well, that puts all journalism in jeopardy, because any future story that involves a military source, or even just an op-ed written by a military person, or just a Facebook post by any military man or woman serving overseas, could be considered aiding the enemy, even if it contains potentially innocuous information. You know, we have to remember during this whole controversy, for the last 3 years, the government has been screaming from the rooftops that this has hurt national security. Yet they can't point to a single person who has been harmed by these disclosures. And, you know, a lot of good has come out of them at the same time, whether we're talking about the Arab Spring or an early end to the Iraq War. So, you know, it's important to keep all of that in perspective when we're talking about this.
Trevor Timm, again, Executive Director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Still with us from the earlier part of our program, David Rifkin, Washington attorney, expert on national security law, served in the Department of Justice and the White House in the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. Mr. Rifkin, welcome back. How do you respond to what we've heard? Is there any evidence that, in fact, because of the release of information by Private Manning and the publication by WikiLeaks, that anybody got hurt?
Well, if you ask me, can I give you specific evidence? I cannot. On the other hand, there have been lots and lots of articles in reputable newspapers, including New York Times, Washington Post, that talked about the fact that Mr. Manning, far from being a discriminating whistleblower, by definition somebody who doesn't like a particular policy, first goes for channels, goes to his superiors, then goes to Congress, and then eventually goes to the media, basically had one organizing principle for data released. Everything he had in his possession, which included tons and tons of diplomatic cables, leaving aside all the other things about Guantanamo and how we're prosecuting war in Iraq and Afghanistan, tons of diplomatic cables, every single one he get his hands on, that describe in excruciating detail discussions between our diplomatic personnel overseas and various sympathetic players in the security, foreign affairs, and defense portions of various foreign establishments, who range from being super sympathetic to us to mildly sympathetic. What do you think happened to those people? At the very least, nothing good happened. That's a serious problem. But as I said, it's an unrealistic burden to bear to say, well, the following people got shot or the following people got demoted. But it certainly greatly complicated our ability to conduct diplomacy for any country.
But if you say that nothing, if the best you can say is that nothing good happened to them, how does that justify a life sentence?
Well, I said I cannot at this level tell you and your listeners that the following individual in Nigeria or the following individual in Thailand got demoted or his family suffered. Undoubtedly, the national security establishment in the United States knows what sources have gone silent, what people got reassigned, what people disappeared. But my point is this. There are lots and lots of countries where talking to American diplomatic personnel and telling them what's going on is, to put it mildly, not a career-enhancing move. That's why those things are classified.
Okay. Let me go back to Arun Ruth, Roth, who's covering this for Frontline and The World. Do we expect the government to come forward with evidence that anybody specifically was harmed, or is much of this trial going to be held in secret?
Well, that part, actually, they are going to have witnesses to testify to that, to the damage that may have been caused, but that part of the trial may, in fact, be secret. There is going to be a fair amount. The prosecution estimates about 30% of the trial is going to be closed off. They will be coming out with transcripts of that afterwards, but they'll be redacted. So how heavily they'll be redacted, how much we'll actually know what went on, it's hard to say.
Let me introduce Mark Ambender. He is editor-at-large of The Week, contributing editor at The Atlantic, co-author of Deep State, Inside the Government Secrecy Industry. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
You've talked to some people about the issue of damage. What have you found out?
It is very hard to both quantify and qualify damage. And inevitably, this gets back to the question of what a whistleblower is, because the activist community wants to necessarily define whistleblower very, very broadly. The government's definition for what a whistleblower is includes an assessment of damage. And they want to define what a whistleblower is, the definition of a whistleblower, very, very narrowly. When you engage in a discussion with government officials about the negative ramifications of leaks, what they'll point out is, well, they'll point to previous times in the past where disclosures by spies have harmed national security, and they'll say, well, we don't, you know, I can't tell you the classified information because that itself would be violating the law. But in the Bradley Manning case, there are a couple of ground principles to fall back on. One is that the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, was fairly explicit in saying publicly that while the Manning disclosures made the executive branch less efficient, they were annoying, they certainly created headaches for the State Department, they didn't significantly harm national security. I am certain that that will be brought up by the defense if it hasn't already been brought up by the defense. And as Secretary of State, you could say, well, as Secretary of Defense at the time, you could say, well, he was just trying to tamp down the Fuhrer. Still, it's something that he said. It is the government's responsibility when they make an accusation like they've made against Bradley Manning to provide explicit, specific proof, I think. I don't like the government calling someone a traitor, which is what they're basically calling him, and only saying, well, he made it harder for us to do X. That, to me, doesn't rise to the level of being a traitor. Bradley Manning admits that he's guilty of a felony. He hasn't pled guilty, but he essentially admits it. But he's being treated like he is a traitor, something that he does not resemble in the least.
David Rifkin, how do you respond to that?
Well, again, we're talking about a particular statement. But first of all, both statements and the totality of government statements in this matter would be played out during the judicial proceedings, his court martial. So I agree with my colleague that the defense undoubtedly is going to trot out Gates' statement. One thing I would say, by the way, you know, I have enormous respect for Secretary Gates, who was a fine SecDef. I don't see him as having much visibility or institutional knowledge, if you will, about diplomatic relations. That's for Secretary of State, National Security Council. But again, to basically make an argument that a wholesale disclosure, unprecedented in our history, of an incredible volume of classified information, diplomatic, military, intelligence, is somehow scot-free is undoubtedly
well,
very
nobody says it's
scot-free.
He's going to go to prison for 20 years for the things that he's already conceded.
Well, but, okay, does not cause grave damage, does not cost lives. Again, in the situation we have, and then back to the military stuff, we're, you know, never redacted, and never did Mr. Assange, unlike any reputable newspaper, which is why I don't believe Ivory is a journalist.
Mr. Assange, who, of course, heads WikiLeaks. Go ahead.
Right, but, I mean, what you do is you provide information particularly to a person like that, and it gets published in unredacted forms. It would be a miracle if our sources did not suffer greatly. But my point is this. Why is there a tendency to minimize the consequences of that? It's only a case if you believe that all this classified information nonsense is irrelevant. We should do everything in the sunshine. You know, gentlemen, don't read each other's mail. That is not the kind of world we live in. The people who are making those points are really not talking about the Manning case. They're talking about their overarching philosophical preferences against government operating, protecting national security the way it's always done.
Trevor Tim, again, with the Freedom of the Press Foundation, how do you respond to that? And if, in fact, there was damage done, would a reporter under the same circumstances or Julian Assange or Bradley Manning be responsible?
Well, I think a couple of points are in order here. First, WikiLeaks asked the Defense Department, when they released the Afghan and Iraq war cables, to help them redact. The Defense Department refused, even though they said they would help the New York Times. The same thing happened right before the State Department cables. When the State Department cables came out and when the Iraq war cables came out, they were redacted in concert with media organizations. During the Afghanistan war logs, Julian Assange held back 15,000 cables because he thought that they would end up harming people. And once again, there has never been any allegation by the U.S. government that anybody has come to harm in these cables. In fact, there's been reporting to the contrary that they've actually been exaggerating the damage that these cables have caused. You know, there was a Reuters headline from last year saying the opening paragraph reads, internal U.S. government reviews have determined that the mass leak of diplomatic cables caused only limited damage to U.S. interests abroad, despite the Obama administration's public statements to the contrary. It goes on to say that they were trying to bolster the legal case. That's why that they were saying these things in public when they didn't believe them in private. And that, in fact, the information was only embarrassing and didn't actually cause real damage. Now, you may remember from the Pentagon Papers case, one of the justices said that the overarching goal of the First Amendment is to allow media organizations to publish information that could be embarrassing to the government, but which they wish to suppress. So the idea that WikiLeaks did something wrong and hurt national interest just is false, and they should be treated just like every other journalism organization, because, in fact, if WikiLeaks is ever prosecuted or punished for any charges related to this release, any number of other U.S. news organizations could be charged with the same thing.
Trevor Tim, again, with the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Mr. Rifkin has said he doesn't believe that WikiLeaks is a journalistic organization. We're going to take a very brief break, come back and broaden this conversation out a bit on To the Point from PRI.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
We're only back with To the Point, talking today about the PFC Bradley Manning and the court-martial that he is currently undergoing as a result of releasing enormous amounts of information to WikiLeaks. I want to go back to Mark Ambrinder, who's editor-at-large of The Week and contributing editor to The Atlantic and author of a book called Deep State, Inside the Government Secrecy Industry. To what extent does this case reveal what you refer to as the government secrecy industry?
I think it reveals quite a bit about the government secrecy industry, and it reveals the substantial gap in perception between those who keep the secrets and those who are trying to shake loose the secrets. And it is often very hard to reconcile both interests. The government has a significant equity in protecting national security information. And Mr. Rifkin was absolutely right. No one in the government should be able to, on the basis of their own opinion, simply disclose classified information to anyone and not expect to simply get away, as you put it, scot-free. I don't think there may be some who believe that Bradley Manning should be set free. I don't believe that to be the case. I think in this case, what most people object to is the degree and the nature of the government's prosecution treating him much worse than he deserved on the basis of a rational assessment of not just how much this hurt the government, but how much this harmed the government. But the secrecy industry, or the deep state, as we call it, is very, very self-protective. And that isn't necessarily a bad thing, because there are good secrets and difficult secrets that need to be protected. I mean, governments from time immemorial have used proxies and other people to do the things that they don't want known done in their name. It's hard to find a single government. In fact, I don't know of any government that has ever been pure. And I think it's almost a compact of our democracy that we allow the government to do this, provided that they don't do certain things and that they are subject to certain mechanisms of oversight.
I was just going to say the phrase government secrecy industry, the subtitle of your book, suggests that they're doing more classification of material than they ought to be doing, it seems to me. And I take it that the number of top secret clearances, for example, has vastly increased, as has the amount of information that's being kept secret.
Well, if you tie that back to the disclosure that Verizon is providing bulk data to the intelligence agencies every 90 days and every single transactional record. I mean, there's no discrimination in that. It gives you a sense as to why the government is collecting so much information, in part because there's so much more information to collect. Everywhere somebody goes overseas, they're emitting an electromagnetic signature. They're producing a lot more content. There's simply more types of intelligence together, more ways to gather it. The number of people in the world are expanding. The type of threats are expanding. And, of course, you also have sort of a natural expansion of the national security state. This is it is very rare for the executive branch, once it claims a power, to give it up. So it's in some ways a self-sustaining growth. I will say that a lot of what they collect, though, is just detritus. I mean, I would venture to say that 95% of the stuff that the intelligence community collects or the national security community collects and classifies as secret, they never use. And part of the problem they have is figuring out how to match the resources that they have to analyze all this stuff with all the stuff that they collect. And you're seeing some of the mechanisms for that in the discussion about the FISA court's orders to Verizon and I'm sure other telephone companies.
David Rifkin, very quickly, if you can, back to the Pentagon Papers case and the justice saying that the purpose of the First Amendment is to try to reveal the information that the government wants suppressed. Has that become much more difficult to implement given the technology that's available?
No, a couple of things. First of all, I put this discussion is about Brad Manning, who's a government official who violated his oath, who violated his duties of office. We're not talking about prosecuting a newspaper reporter, and I would be having a totally different discussion if we're talking about the AP or any other investigations, Mr. Rosen, et cetera, et cetera. We're not even talking about prosecuting WikiLeaks. We're talking about the sort of irreducible minimum that the government has always been able to do, which is punish individuals who leak information in violation of their duties. And that is point number one. Point number two, so it has nothing to do with the First Amendment. It's not at all questionable. But there was an issue in Pentagon Papers, of course, was indeed at the core of the First Amendment protected activities by the media. The second point is, look, I'm frankly tired of hearing 100 times how the government is a clumsy beast, the government overclassifies, the government underutilizes. All of it is true. But the notion that somehow we have people on the outside who are in the better position to assess what the government really needs, what information is useful, what harm is sustained if it's leaked, is laughable. I mean, the reason we have government clumsy as it is in a variety of domestic and foreign policy spheres is no other alternative.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it at that. And thank you all very much for being with us. David Rifkin, again, lawyer formerly with the Justice Department in the White House during Republican administrations. Mark Ambinder at The Week, his book, Deep State, Inside the Government Secrecy Industry, and our other guests as well. Many thanks to all of you. Today's program produced by Christian Bordahl with Katie Cooper, Evan George, and Sonia Garcia. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast, as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.